Oye, the United States Court of Appeals for Veterans Claims is now in session. The Honorable Michael P. Allen presiding. All of the business before this court draw near and you shall be heard. God bless the United States and this honorable court.
Well, good afternoon. I am Chief Judge Allen, and I'm joined by Judge Peach, who's on my right here on the bench, and remotely by Judge Bartley, who is on WebEx. We're convened this afternoon to consider arguments in the matter of Wayne Sellers versus Dennis McDonough, Secretary of Veterans Affairs, case number 23-4114. Would counsel, beginning with the Secretary's counsel, please enter your appearance for the record?
Nathan Kirshner for the Secretary, and with me at counsel table, Carolyn Washington, Deputy Chief Counsel.
Welcome both.
Kenny Dohakis for Mr. Sellers.
Nice to see you again, Mr. Dohakis. And so I understand the Secretary would like to reserve 5 minutes for rebuttal. We'll make that happen, and feel free to proceed, Mr. Kirshner.
Good afternoon, and may it please the court. Your Honors, the court should dismiss this appeal as untimely because it was filed many years after the date the board decision was mailed. VA mailed a copy of a June 1996 board decision to appellant at its last known address, as was its duty under Section 7104E at the time. At that time, appellant had not informed VA of any new updated address or that he was homeless. Furthermore, at that time, there was no possible, plausible address in the claims file when the board mailed this decision. That
Mr. Kirshner,
June 1996 board.
Mr. Kirshner, if
I think
I could,
we have Judge Bartley.
If I could interrupt you there. You said that VA had not informed VA that he was homeless. Is that correct? Is that what you just said?
That's correct, Your Honor.
So does that mean that what evidence did you look at to make that determination? Like, he says that he was an inpatient in some VA facilities, including psych facilities during this time. And
yeah,
did you look at those records, or do we know what those records say?
And Yes, Your Honor. So from the record, that is all in the preliminary record that we filed with the court. We are not aware that at the time of the 1996 board decision that he was hospitalized or that he was a VA inpatient treatment. Those records seem to indicate that from approximately, I think it was January of 1996 until sometime in 1998, he was not receiving treatment because there's that date missing in those records. And so he was just, essentially nowhere to be found, but he wasn't under VA's care at that time. And the rest of the record doesn't indicate a statement where he says, at that time during 1996 in June 1996, I was in fact homeless until, I think it's the preliminary record at page one, his statement from this April where he said at that time he was homeless and he was using either an Olive Garden or a Grace Mission, I believe, as his address where he was receiving mail. But at that time, he didn't inform VA that he was receiving mail at either of those locations.
Uh-huh. Mr. Kirshner, I we're not quite understanding each other. So I have the preliminary ROP here in front of me. That's what you're referring to?
Yes, Your Honor.
And that doesn't include actual treatment records during this time period. So I guess my question is, do we know what he said to doctors around this time period?
We don't know what he might have said to doctors around that time period, but there was nothing in the record that we've been able to find to show that he was receiving any kind of treatment from VA apart from the dates indicated in those Capri records where it lists the treatment dates in the file itself. So during that time period, there is no record that he was receiving VA treatment.
Thank you.
Could I jump in for 1 second about this? I mean, it seems, without getting bogged down into the details in particular, the story here seems to be one of VA doing a lot of things that are laudatory. In other words, leading up to the board's mailing of its decision, it seemed like the board did a lot to try to figure out where he was and seemed to understand he was hard to track down, whether he was technically homeless or not, right? And it really does seem that at the time the board mailed the decision, it sort of knew that it wasn't going to reach him because it had sort of exhausted everything it did, reached out to DAV, all of this, right? But then the decision comes back, and then the board does something. It submits it. This is the preliminary record at 27, right? It sends this referral of correspondence. Now, this is a long way to get to the question, which is, I think the secretary's position is you mailed the document to the last known address and there wasn't a possible or plausible address in the record, whatever that phrase means. And that exhausted the agency's duties under law. Is that basically what you're saying at the time?
Basically, yes, Your Honor.
Okay. Well, then, though, the board seems to take it upon itself to send out this referral of correspondence to the RO that says, please remail when the correct address is ascertained with any necessary explanation. This reminds me of the idea that the agency can bind itself to greater duties and responsibilities than the law would otherwise impose. So even if there was no obligation on the board to do anything, why didn't the board bind itself, bind the agency to do what essentially appellant says should be done, which is send it back out there with no time frame to remail? And then I think your position in one of your submissions was that there's no indication that the RO took any action on the referral at all.
We don't have evidence on that one way or the other, Your Honor. But I think I understand your question about an ongoing duty. And this is where the Davis case becomes really instructive, because Davis had a very similar fact pattern to this one, in that after the date the initial board decision was sent in Davis, they also sent a referral of correspondence. And the request, or the question before the court, was, what date do we use to calculate the start for the 7104E notice? And in Davis, the court said, for 7104E notice, use that initial date of the board decision, even when this referral of correspondence happened after. These further efforts to notify by the agency come under essentially a separate duty that's under 5104 instead of 7104E. So the court in Davis drew that distinction, which I think really is kind of the important distinction for this case. Davis has said that the limiting date is that date of the board decision for the purposes of the 120-day appeal period. But in terms of VA's ongoing duty to notify, you know, of course, further attempts should be made to give the appellant the decision. But that's a different statutory operation than the statutory operation that leads to the 120-day appeal period here at the court.
Although it seems to me that our recent cases, I think most of them dealing with the M21, Overton and the case about the Thailand base, Stover, really post-date Davis by quite a bit, right? And so do you think Davis considered that issue? Meaning, I did not read Davis to consider and reject the notion that the agency can adopt a greater rule for itself than the statute applies.
Well, Your Honor, I think, for the purposes of this motion to dismiss, that Davis is pretty clear and on point. I think I don't recall whether it post-dated Overton or not, but of course we'd be happy to provide some supplemental briefing on that. I'm not sure that Overton considered Davis or this particular factual situation. I think Davis discussed the interplay between the two statutes pretty well.
Yeah, well, Davis definitely predated Overton because it was 2003. So, okay. Sticking with Davis for a second, it frames the question in an odd way for me, and I know I issued a briefing order when I had this case as a single judge. But talking about the presumption of regularity, could you just, I'm still trying to get my hands around what the secretary says we're presuming, because usually it's we presume you mailed it, but we know you mailed it, and we know it came back. So I'm just wondering, what is it? And I'm not faulting you, because Davis framed this in the context of the presumption. I just can't figure out what we're supposed to presume.
I think it's a little bit broader than the what we think of as the presumption of regularity in mailing. It's kind of like the language from Romero, talking about the more kind of general presumption that official acts will happen in the regular course of business. So we are presuming that VA not only mailed this address, but because the statute, 7104E at the time, said to mail the board decision to the last known address of record of the claimant and of the representative, if any, that is the action that was undertaken, you know, and that we presume was undertaken by the board. And then when we come back, you know, within Davis to look at how to rebut that presumption, then we need to have evidence not only that the decision itself was not delivered, but also evidence that there was that other possible or plausible address.
So the problem I'm having is that we know all of the stuff that you said at the beginning happened. We don't need to presume it happened because we know it was mailed. We know it was mailed to his last known address, and we know it came back. Right. So although Davis doesn't frame it this way, it seems to me what Davis is really getting at is, when the board does these things, right, mails to the last known address and it comes back, what obligations, if any, does VA have to do anything else? I mean, even though Davis doesn't frame it that way, would you agree that that's fundamentally what it's talking about?
It is, but I think it's also talking about, again, kind of more importantly, the time frame for the tolling, because you know, there is that separate duty, an ongoing duty under 5104. So it's a separate duty from the duty to notify that kind of starts the clock for the appeal. So within sort of that presumption of regularity analysis, you know, like you noted earlier, I think VA did do a lot of things here that were really laudable, and they tried to find really sort of any address so that they could send it to a more current address, to the current address, instead of the last known address, which they had, you know, trouble getting it to. But at some point, the board issues the decision, and, you know, that starts the clock. Unless there's some showing that, you know, VA didn't follow what it's supposed to do in statute, and unless the presumption of regularity rebutted, that's kind of unfortunately, the end of the matter. That doesn't have anything to do with the ongoing duty to notify under 5104, but it does start that clock for the purposes of 7104E.
Judge Bartley, did you have a question? It looked like you did, but maybe not.
Yes, I do. So, Mr. Kirshner, why wouldn't our CHECO line of cases just kick in here? Why isn't there an extraordinary circumstance? There appears to have been non-receipt, and he was homeless. So can you follow through what distinguishes this from that? And also, the three requirements under CHECO, so how far do you see him going in terms of meeting those requirements?
Happy to, Your Honor. So first of all, I think I need to make an important distinction between the presumption of regularity and equitable tolling. So in order to even reach an equitable tolling situation, I think the court has to agree with the secretary here, because of course the court can't toll a filing deadline if the filing isn't late. So first the court's going to have to agree with the secretary to find the presumption of regularity attached, and this is a late filing. So once it's a late filing, then we get into the discussion about equitable tolling, Your Honor. And so along CHECO and that line of cases, of course, the analysis for equitable tolling is on a case-by-case basis. And along CHECO and Barrett and Toomer, kind of that whole line, there are three different aspects. There is an extraordinary circumstance. There is that the extraordinary circumstance caused the appellant to be unable to timely process their appeal, and that the third circumstance, or the third, I guess, element, is that the the appellant exercised due diligence in pursuing their appeal, you know, once they were made aware of it or attempting to continue their appeal. Here, the secretary doesn't think really any of those are satisfied. For example, if we go directly to CHECO, which involved homelessness, the court in CHECO found that the presumption, pardon me, not the presumption of regularity, I'm saying that a lot, found that the that equitable tolling applied because the extraordinary circumstance of homelessness prevented the appellant from receiving mail. The appellant in that case said, I am homeless, and because I am homeless, I was not receiving mail. In here, in the preliminary record at page one, the April of 2024 statement, appellant has said that when he was homeless during this time period, and again, at the time of the 1996 decision, there was nothing in the record to inform us that he was homeless, but he said in the April of 2024 filing that at the time of this decision, he was receiving mail, and he was receiving it either at the Olive Garden or at the, I think it's the Grace Central Mission. Now, under VA Regulation 1.710, VA would have accepted either of those places as his address. He could have written into VA and said, you know, please send mail to me, care of Mr. Sellers at the Olive Garden in Chicago, and VA would have sent the decision there. So unlike CHECO, this isn't a case where appellant has said that, you know, he was homeless, and because he was homeless, he was not receiving mail. He said, has recently informed the court that he was homeless, and this is where he was getting his mail. So there's an important factual distinction there. Similarly, under Barrett, which would go to I hope that answers your question, Your Honor. Barrett's another circumstance I can get into more if you'd like.
Well, I did want you to address all three of what I think of as the CHECO requirements, the direct result that, you know, but you don't think that he meets the first one. So is your position that you don't have to go through the other two?
Well, no, Your Honor. I mean, I can go down the list if you would like. So, you know,
but
before you do though,
Mr. Kirshner, do you think it's significant that he didn't let VA know of his homelessness at the time? If he indeed was homeless, I mean, how significant is it? You were just mentioning he didn't tell VA and they had no way of knowing. And if they had, they would have sent something to the Olive Garden address. By the way, I'm not sure that he would have received it anyway, because I think it read to me like he arbitrarily, I mean, he was living, in that parking lot or whatever, but it didn't sound like he actually got their approval to give people that as his address. I think he was just doing it, thinking, well, this is the closest I can come to an address at this time. But how crucial is it that he didn't tell them that he didn't let VA know that he was homeless? Wouldn't he still meet the first the requirement of being homeless, though? I mean,
well, Your Honor, I think that because of the operation of 1.710, which allows VA to use any address to a claimant, regardless of what it is, even, a CO address or a post office box or anything like that, As long as he is actually receiving mail somewhere, which he seems to indicate from his own filing, it seems that the fact of his homelessness for mailing purposes did not have the same extraordinary circumstance impact, if you will, as it did for the appellant in Checo. Because in Checo, that claimant said specifically, I was not receiving mail because I was homeless. And here there seems to be a factual distinction there. So that, though it's, you know, it certainly seems like homelessness would be considered generally an extraordinary circumstance. In here, that circumstance did not necessarily lead to his inability to receive this board decision. And I think that's where we kind of transition into that second part of the equitable tolling analysis, where, you know, the extraordinary circumstances, assuming that we would concede homelessness is an extraordinary circumstance, once we go over that hurdle, the extraordinary circumstance has to be the cause of the non-receipt. And here it seems like the homelessness wouldn't necessarily be the cause of the non-receipt, because he was receiving mail. And under Heisen and its progeny, you know, as long as he's keeping VA informed of his address, no matter where he's receiving mail, VA can send that mail to him there. That doesn't seem to, again, present the circumstance where the extraordinary circumstance leads to the inability to continue to the appeal. And then we go on, you know, to the third aspect, the due diligence in pursuit of the appeal, and that kind of brings into mind the question of when appellant actually became aware of the board's decision. Because in 2007, when he came back to VA and requested benefits again, he did request that VA reopen his claim, which would tend to indicate that he knew that his claim was finally decided, and, you know, therefore that he may have known that the board issued this decision, whether or not he actually received it. At that point, perhaps he could have continued his appeal. That would have been evidence of diligence. But I think in this case, when, you know, even after 2007, another, you know, 15 years or so have passed, it calls into question the appellant's diligence in pursuit of the appeal for the court to use equitable tolling. So it's a long way to say it, but I think, you know, there are problems with each of the three prongs of the equitable tolling analysis here, Your Honor.
Yes, I have a question. I'd like to go back to sort of what Judge Allen was getting to. In the board decision, they acknowledged that this was not going to get, this mailing would not get to him. Well, why would they do that, acknowledge it in a decision? Why didn't they just mail it and see what happens?
I don't know, Your Honor. But, you know, I think it shows.
Was it preemptory, maybe?
It's a pretty old board decision, and I really don't know why they put that in there. But I think, you know, it perhaps, and this is speculation, is simply out of concern and diligence. You know, they acknowledged that they had been trying to find him. They'd been unable to find a possible or plausible known address at the time, and yet he was up in docket order, and the appeals are to be considered in docket order, so they had to issue his decision when it was his time.
So these efforts that have been termed laudable efforts in finding his address were made before the decision came out. Were mailed. So were there any sort of laudable steps taken after the decision was returned, the mail was returned, other than forwarding it to another RO to say, when you find his address, can you mail it to him?
Not that I am aware of, Your Honor, with respect to providing notice of this particular decision. It looks like the referral of correspondence was the next step to that same RO in Chicago. But that was also the same next step that was taken in Davis, which is around the same time frame. So I think it sounds like pretty standard practice at the time.
Although, and we might not be able to reach this because this wasn't argued directly, but, and this is the bad part for the secretary, that you get a guy who used to teach constitutional law. But after Davis, years after Davis, the Supreme Court decided Jones v. Flowers. And Jones v. Flowers involved did notice under the Due Process Clause. And basically a city was mailing like a tax notice, and it did everything right, except it decided to send it return receipt requested. It didn't have to. It could have mailed it regular mail. But because it sent it return receipt requested, and it then the city learned actually that it didn't reach it. And what John Roberts wrote for the unanimous court in Jones was, hey, what you did at the beginning was fine under the Due Process Clause, but now you have actual knowledge that it didn't reach them. And so you have an obligation to do more that you wouldn't have had to start out with. Why, assuming that we reach it, right, that we can reach that argument, and to follow on what Judge Peach was saying, given that the board acknowledged ahead of time that it was likely not going to reach it, and then had actual knowledge that it did, why shouldn't we hold the board to what it told the RO to do in the referral of correspondence, which is, we've now got to do something more because the Constitution says that the notice that the statute says is good enough didn't work.
Well, Your Honor, I see my time is about to expire. If I could have some indulgence.
Well, luckily, since I asked the question, I will say, sure, Dawn, 5 more minutes, please. Thank you.
Thank you, Your Honor. So the constitutional question, I think when we're looking at Jones, you know, Jones looked at Mullane and others and noted in particular that actual notice is not required. And I think if you agree with appellant here, you're going to be crafting some kind of new rule that essentially would be saying actual notice is required.
No, wouldn't the rule be actual notice is not required, but when the government learns actually that the notice didn't reach the intended recipient, now you've got an added obligation to do something more. So it's not saying that you have to have actual notice, because Jones v. Flowers said, listen, if you had put this thing in the U.S. mail and it just never came back to you, and the person says, I didn't get it, the answer would be you took under Mullane's terms, you took all steps necessary to lead to actual notice, even though it doesn't lead to actual notice. But once I learn that it doesn't, now I have to do something more.
Well, I think, Your Honor, based on the facts of this case, the timing is important, because in Jones, what we have is that was the first thing after the property notice. They said, okay, we're sufficient, that's good. And the court said, no, you need to take reasonable efforts to try and find some other address for this claimant or deliver it to him deliver it to him in some other way, tack it up on his door, send it regular mail. What happened here, because VA was trying to comply with the statute, is VA front-loaded the reasonable efforts. We took all of those laudable efforts prior to sending this decision. But when it came down to it, the decision had to be sent. And as in Jones, the question becomes, well, what more efforts are reasonable at that point? And because of the Capri records that show that he wasn't in VA treatment at the time of this decision, we don't know where he was at the time of this decision. Because there was no other possible or plausible address in the file at the time of the decision, there simply, you know, there weren't the other options that were reasonable that VA could have used to try to effectuate the notice. And I think, you know, that's really where not only Jones, but also this court's notice cases, they all come back to that reasonableness aspect. And so I think here, you know, we're in a case where VA did everything that was reasonable at the time of the board's decision. And, you know, under the case law as it exists, under, you know, Davis, there's no requirement to do more at that point. Once the reasonable efforts have been exhausted, and here it certainly appears that they were, there's nothing more to do, and the presumption can attach. But again, that kind of gets into, we're coming back a little from Judge Bartley's equitable tolling space, and we're back into the presumption of regularity. So if the court, you know, does find that the notice was sufficient, then we'll move to the equitable tolling things. But I hope that answers your question, Your Honor.
It does. Have you, one other question, I don't know if every once in a while I see Judge Bartley move on the screen, and I can't tell if she's asking a question. So if I interrupted you, I'm sorry. Have you, the Secretary, not you personally necessarily, given any thought that this is a bad set of facts to be making law or potentially constitutional law on, right? You know, I described it in my mind, you know, laudable doing these things ahead of time. But then if you were to describe it to a man or woman on the street to say, okay, the government has done a lot of work to figure out that the address it has isn't correct. So what is the government going to do? It's going to mail the thing to the address that it's done all this work to determine it knows will not be delivered, so that then it can say that the presumption of regularity allows us to presume something in a way that says that the veteran can't prevail. I'm hoping there aren't tons of these cases out there. And I know this has been a long time, but it just seems like this set of facts is just not a, it's just not a good one to be making a lot of law on.
It's a sympathetic case, Your Honor. But, you know, Davis and the law talks about the presumption, how it attaches, and it seems to be applicable in this case. So,
but again, the presumption of what? If I'm going to write this down and I'm going to say we are going to presume what are we presuming?
All the court needs to do is to presume that VA fulfilled its statutory duty to mail the board decision to the last known address of record, because that's all it takes for that notice to be sufficient under the court's case law. So the only presumption.
But don't we know that for certain? I mean, we know that for certain. We know it without a presumption, right?
Well, I believe so, Your Honor. It's, you know, I think a lot has gone into the presumption of regularity here, and I think that that's what was brought up in the response to the motion to dismiss, to say that.
Well, and the only reason I'm bringing this up is that it may not matter. It may be asking how many, you know, angels dance on the head of a pin or something, except for this one thing, is that if you start out and you frame this through the presumption of regularity lens, then it shifts a burden to the appellant to do something, right, to rebut the presumption, whatever we're presuming. Whereas if you looked at it, just the way I'm looking at it, through the Jones v. Flowers idea, the fact that the government knows it wasn't delivered imposes a burden on the government to do something, right? So there is a burden difference here. In any event, you know, you've answered that and you've done the briefing. So.
If the decision had added the phrase to the had added this to the phrase which said, we don't have any correct address. We know it's not going to get to him, is basically what they said. But if they'd added the phrase, this is being mailed to his last known address, would we be here today?
I think that's what we've been trying to show today, Your Honor, and I think the circumstances would be pretty much the same. We'd probably still be here having this argument.
Or if you didn't even mention in the decision that you don't know where he lives, then it to me would be what a kind of a pardon phrase, a garden variety. Mm-hmm. Okay.
Judge Bartley, do you have anything else?
No.
Thank you. We'll give you your full rebuttal time. And Mr. Tahakis, you can take 5 extra minutes if you need it.
Thank you, Your Honor. I hope not to need it, but I may. There's a
lot of us.
Going
okay.
on here. So I'd like to start with this presumption, because I think that as we explained in primarily our supplemental briefing, but even in some of the other pleadings, there's no basis for using the presumption of regularity in this situation, because as you, Chief Judge Allen, has indicated, we know that the VA sent it to an address that it knew ahead of time would never reach Mr. Sellers. And So the presumption is there, as the secretary concedes in his responses, to presume that the VA sent it to an address. And that address happens to be the last known address, and that's what the statute requires. And so the secretary's position is that that's all he has to do. But that ignores what Jones v. Flowers talks about, in that the Constitution requires notice. Now, Jones was issued in 2006. Davis was in 2003. Cushman was later in 2009. Cushman says that claims for benefits are constitutional protected property interests. So it makes sense that at least when Davis was decided, it wasn't settled that this was a constitutional right to notice and due process. And Jones was the first time where the Supreme Court addressed an issue where the notice came back. And so what we would urge the court to consider is that Davis is no longer good law, period. And it doesn't even really apply to this case, because there is no presumption of regularity that has any bearing on anything that happened here. Again, they sent it to a place they knew it would not arrive, or it would not get to him. And it would have had the same effect if they had mailed it to me. As a private citizen in the 90s when I was in high school, it would have been the exact same effect in sending it somewhere that they knew it would never reach Mr. Sellers. So
what do you say to the secretary's sort of practical response, which is they did this stuff that I had described as laudatory. They tried a lot to figure out where they could send it. They then decide, we don't know. And the secretary's position is sort of the number of the case came up and it had to do something. And so it did it.
Sure, Your Honor. And I think that the answer to that question is in Jones. And I would just point out that in our initial response to the motion to dismiss, I'm looking on pages 2 to 3, we talk about the fact that he did not get notice, and we know that. And then we argued that there were other reasonable ways of getting this notice to Mr. Sellers, highlighting the fact that he was in treatment, he was in and out of the hospital, he was inpatient, physically in the hospital for days at a time under the secretary's care. And so we specifically said that VA had other possible and plausible addresses, and it is not reasonable that given Congress's mandate to provide notice that the board would make arrangements to obtain an address or some other way to contact the veteran who received treatment, to include inpatient treatment for substance abuse on a somewhat regular basis. So we think that that opens the door for the court to consider the Jones ruling.
So, but under Davis itself, it's funny, Davis uses, and I think it uses this three times. It's the law that, right? I mean, unless it's been undermined or something, but it says that the possible and plausible addresses are at the time of the board's decision, the mailing of the decision, right? So it sets that as the marker in time. Leave Jones aside for a second. In our case, do you agree with the Secretary's counsel that there is no evidence that at that time he was receiving inpatient care?
He was not at the moment the board's decision was issued. That's correct, Your Honor.
So if we take what I've called, in preparing for the case, the strict Davis approach, right, which seems to take like a photo finish and it's like right at the moment of mailing. And it suggests that if VA does step one, which is mails to the last known address, that's going to be good enough unless there's a plausible or possible address in the file at that time. If we apply that strictly and we say it isn't undermined, doesn't that mean you can't prevail under Davis?
No, Your Honor, because the facts of Davis were at the time of the mailing, the VA had no indication that it would not reach the veteran. They sent it to an address, and then he didn't get it. In this case, they knew before they sent it that it would not get to Mr. Sellers.
And so what rule would you adopt then? That's a fair distinction, because I think, as Judge Peach's questions pointed out, whether it's good and laudable or just really silly, my words, not Judge Peach's words, she'd be much more erudite. The board says, we have this address, we know it's not going to work, but we're going to mail it. I mean, are you suggesting that what we do is we adopt a rule for that situation, right, you think? Which is not a wacky idea, because it's such a strange thing. And if we did adopt that rule, a rule in that situation, what should the rule be?
I think the rule needs to be what Jones and the cases that Jones talked about say, Your Honor. So the Constitution requires notice, and that's the baseline. The Jones court says that the agency, the government, whoever it is that's trying to affect this property right, has to provide notice in a way that is reasonably calculated to get that notice to the affected person. And sending it to an address they know doesn't work is not reasonably calculated. So the general rule, and it talks about this, where the statute 7104E is one of those, where it says we're going to send it to the last known address. If the VA has no indication that that's not going to work, they're done. They've complied with the Constitution, and that's what Jones says. But when they know ahead of time that it's not going to reach them, and that's the cases that Jones relied on, Walker and some of the others, or as in Jones, when they get it back from the post office and they now know it didn't get to the intended recipient, they have to do more. The Constitution requires more. And what Jones describes is additional reasonable steps to attempt to provide notice. And it has to consider the unique information about an intended recipient. And here's the key, regardless of whether a statutory scheme is reasonably calculated to provide notice in the ordinary case. And that's Jones at 230. So Jones covers this situation to a T. You can't send something out. No, and it talks about, you know, it's the same as the example that they put in Jones, where they hand it to the postman and he drops it and it goes into the gutter. And they're like, oh, well, we're good. We gave it, we did our part. That's what the secretary is asking this court to endorse, is that as long as I hand it off to the postman, regardless of what I'd later find out, I'm done. My obligations are done. Jones says that's wrong. The Constitution requires additional reasonable steps. And the directive from the board where it told the RO, that's a reasonable step. It's something that they could have done. It's something that they actually decided that they could do, so that when they got an address in 2007, they could give them notice. In 2007, the VA had an address. They were communicating with Mr. Sellers. He was finally sober from his drug addiction. He was in stable housing. There was no indication that he was not getting the mail that was sent to him from the VA, and it was reasonable, as recognized by the board's directive, to give notice at that time. And we think it's also reasonable that the fact that he was being housed by the secretary in his medical facilities, it's also reasonable that they would have, again, through the homeless veterans outreach program that they had, to have interacted with Mr. Sellers. One of their, and this is where the duty to, I'm sorry, the presumption of soundness would apply. We know that they had.
Presumption of soundness?
I'm sorry. Presumption of regularity. Thank you.
Okay. Well, only one presumption at a time, for goodness sake.
The presumption of regularity would have applied because, again, I highlighted in our briefing in a footnote that we don't have the then current policies that were directing the staff at the VHA. But we do know that with the homeless veterans program, there was a lot of interaction trying to get them access to benefits, trying to get them access to housing. And so it's not unreasonable that the secretary, and I think this is really where the distinction comes in, is that the secretary here is arguing that the Board of Veterans Appeals is the only one with an obligation, but the board acts for the secretary, and the secretary is charged with providing notice. And I would just, He acts through the Veterans Health Administration, through the Board of Veterans Appeals, Veterans Benefit Administration, and all the other subsecretaries that are out there, but it's the secretary that is charged with providing this notice by the Constitution. So it's not unreasonable for his Veterans Health Administration, who we know interacted with Mr. Sellers soon after this decision was issued, knowing with full knowledge that he never received notice at all, it's not unreasonable for the secretary to have attempted some kind of notice in any of these interactions. At the very least, they could have told him, hey, by the way, Mr. Sellers, your claim has been denied. If you'd like a copy, go by the regional office and they'll get it for you. I mean, I think that that's perfectly a reasonable step that they could have taken to let Mr. Sellers know.
But they didn't know where he was to say that to him.
Well, they did, Your Honor. He was inpatient in the Veterans Administration hospital system several times.
You're saying the institution knew?
Yes, Your Honor.
Well, and later, right? I just want to make sure of the time, right? So because your argument makes perfect sense, but it requires us first to say that there was a continuing obligation to provide notice, right?
Yes, Your Honor.
Okay.
And that's what Jones says. And again, we highlighted the facts in Jones. 2 years later, the court said, even though you did nothing for 2 years, you can still do something. And in fact, this was the case was decided many years later, and that the state was required to provide notice before they can do the tax sale. So again, it's the reasonableness of it under the unique circumstances of each individual. And we're not necessarily looking for a blanket rule that every time a homeless veteran it receives a board decision that the secretary has to move heaven and earth to do anything, but it's very unique to his specific situation. And in Mr. Sellers' unique situation, he was being housed in the VA hospitals, treated for, we have in August 15th to September 2nd, 1997, just a year later, he was in the VA's hospital, inpatient, that we know of. Again, the record is very unclear, and I can say from experience that there's a lot of old paper records from the 90s that don't make their way into the electronic record. So I am fairly confident that there are outstanding records that we can't see. We can see that he was treated, but we don't see the actual treatment record. So we know that there's some outstanding records, but under long-established case law, that is all constructively before the secretary. And so that would be there anyways.
But again, just to put, this is the fundamental point of legal disagreement, I think, between the parties, right? And see if you agree with me. That at the time that the board mailed the decision, if all the board needed to do was comply with Davis, and that was it, then the fact that a year later VA knew where he was would be legally meaningless under Davis, because they didn't have any possible or plausible addresses in the file at the time that they mailed the board decision, right? Whereas I think your argument is, well, no, had they mailed the board decision to the last known address and they didn't find out that it didn't reach him, then they've done what the statute requires and what the Constitution requires, because they don't have any indication that it came back. And so, you know, it doesn't matter. But because they actually did know, now they had a continuing obligation, so that when he then checks in, I guess not just figuratively, actually checks in to the secretary a year later, that obligation kicks in under the Jones logic to say, ah, okay, now we've got something else we can do. We can literally do the same thing of nailing it on the door outside his hospital. I mean, that seems to be the legal break between the two of you.
Yes, Your Honor. But I just want to point out, and this is from our most recent filing in April in response to the court's order. Walker was issued in 1957. When notice is a person's due process, which is a mere gesture, is not due process. Means employed must be such as one desirous of actually informing the absentee might reasonably adopt to accomplish it. And Jones highlighted a couple other cases where the agency knew it would not reach its intended recipient. And so, again, Davis deals with a case where the secretary had no indication that the mailing would not reach its intended recipient. 1956, 1970 was the other case from the Supreme Court where they said that if you know ahead of time that you're not going to get it to the intended recipient, that's not notice. And you can't rely on your processes if you already know it's not going to work.
I'm with you about what the cases say. What I'm just trying to do is to say, if we just had what I call the strict version of Davis, right, which is all we do is reread Davis and we apply its two steps. In this case, there isn't a factual dispute about whether or not there is or isn't a plausible address in the record at the time the decision was mailed, right? I know you, not you personally, lawyers hate to give up anything, but it does seem to me there's no evidence of that.
There's no evidence. I agree that when the board mailed the decision, there was no evidence of a place they could send it to get to the veteran. That's a correct statement. But again, if they know it's not going to get to him, then the presumption has no effect because the presumption just assumes that they mailed it and that the post office delivered it and that it would have reached its intended recipient. And really, I would actually frame it more in line with what Jones talks about in using these statutory methods are constitutionally appropriate. But again, if we know for a fact it's not going to get there, then it's you can't just rely on that. The secretary can't rely on that. So
do you, I don't think you do, but let me ask anyway, attribute any bad faith to the VA?
Absolutely not, Your Honor. I mean, I agree. I mean, I think they did try hard to find this guy, and unfortunately they couldn't. I mean, he was in a bad place, in a bad way for a very long time, and, you know, just because of his service. I mean, all of these, his addictions, his drug use, psychiatric conditions, we know that claim is still out there. We're trying to get that substantiated, but talking with him, it's clear to me at least that this all stems from his service. And even if it doesn't, it is a mental health issue. And so there was no bad faith on the part of the VA. But I do think that it's disingenuous to say that all I have to do is send it somewhere I know it's not going to get to you and my job is done. And that position is in complete contrast to what the record shows where the board then said, hey, RO, when you guys can find him, let's get him a copy of this decision so that he can be notified. Even then, they recognized that the notice was important and that was a reasonable additional step that the board actually took, but the RO didn't follow through with. The mailing never happened when they made contact with him again in 2007 or even earlier at the hospital. We would ask, though, that Davis either be overruled based on the holding in Jones or just overruled because it conflicted with prior case law, in particular the cases from the Supreme Court that we cited from the 50s and the 70s.
Although, as I understand what you just argued, we wouldn't have to overrule. We couldn't, as a three-judge panel, overrule it. But I think I understood your argument to be that this situation is different from Davis in the sense that here there's evidence on the face of the board decision that it knew that the mailing was likely not to reach the veteran. So as I understood your argument just a moment ago, we would be free to craft a different rule than Davis in that scenario because Davis doesn't control.
Yes, sir.
Is that fair to capture?
Okay. That's my primary argument, but I think that if the court does find that Davis is applicable, that it's contrary to all other established law, primarily Jones and the Supreme Court cases cited there. And again, I mean, from Davis, only sorry, that's, let me put that aside. So tolling, Judge Bartley asked about tolling, and we did ask for equitable tolling. We didn't necessarily expand upon it in great detail because of the court's orders. We're more focused on other matters. But I just want to be clear that when we asked for tolling, we were not asking that the court toll this case because he was homeless. The extraordinary circumstance is not Mr. Sellers' homelessness. The extraordinary circumstance is the fact that he didn't receive the decision. And we know he didn't receive the decision. And so that is directly caused him to be unable to timely file the notice of appeal. And diligence, what can he do except to receive notice? He had no indication that the board had ever made a decision. And in normal circumstances, perhaps somebody who's not homeless and who's not being psychiatrically treated extensively would kind of be aware that, you know, it's been 10 years, maybe I ought to check in on that. But I don't know I'm not aware of any case law that really requires the veteran to do something when they're not even aware that something has to be done. And so the extraordinary circumstance is the fact that he did not receive the decision. And in our response to the motion to dismiss, we talked about how the illness kind of contributed to him not receiving the notice. But we know, what, regardless of how it happened, we know he didn't receive the notice. And so the fact that he did not get notice, the fact that he didn't get the appellate rights, the fact that he didn't get told how he can even appeal or that he can appeal, prevented him from filing the appeal entirely and certainly timely. And the diligence occurred once I was able to access his records, and within a few weeks we were able to file the appeal. And so when the extraordinary circumstance ended, I mean, I would even argue that Mr. Seller still was never given notice by the secretary. Obviously, I provided that to him after July of 2023. But once the extraordinary circumstance ended, notice was provided to him and to me through me. We filed the appeal within days, and so it should be found to be timely.
What about the secretary's argument that, I'm forgetting the date, I think it's 2007, but I might be wrong, where Mr. Sellers said to the VA that he wanted to reopen his denial, I guess, of service connection that was the subject of the decision that we're talking about. What, if any, impact does that have on the equitable tolling analysis?
None, Your Honor, because we don't know when. Let me back up. Because notice was never provided to him, and there's no evidence that notice was ever provided to him. All that tells us is that he was generally aware that his claims had been denied in the past. And
so is there a distinction, though, between not getting notice for purposes of starting the 120-day appeal clock versus once we're in the world of equity, equitable tolling, where I think the secretary is right, and I'm assuming you'll agree, that if we're going to equitably toll something, we have to assume that the deadline has already passed.
Yes, Your Honor.
Okay. So once we've done that, then it would seem to me that maybe the fact that somebody has notice, not technical notice, but notice in a colloquial sense that something has happened, could then impact the equitable analysis, because now, well, they know they should try to do something.
I don't think so, Your Honor, because the extraordinary circumstance is that he never received notice. And there's no evidence that notice was provided to Mr. Sellers at all. We can, there can be some implied knowledge of something had happened in the past, but without actual notice with appellate rights, the extraordinary circumstance is still in existence, and it's still causing him to be unable to appeal. It could be that Mr. Sellers wasn't even aware that the court existed. Certainly when he first started his claims, there was no veterans court. And it's not unreasonable for many veterans to never know that the court existed. And I run into veterans every day today and they are unaware that this court exists and that it can review decisions from the VA until they get that notice from the VA that tells them, here's how you do it. You send your notice of appeal here. Here's your timeline. So the extraordinary circumstance is not that he didn't know his claim had been denied. The extraordinary circumstance is that he did not receive the notice with the appellate rights attached. I would also point out that the secretary has not once disputed that Mr. Sellers was homeless. And that is an important fact, and we would ask that the court take that as a concession, that he was homeless. And there's nothing in the record to indicate that he was not. I mean, other than the court finding that he is.
So why is that? So I have to be careful how I frame this to you. Based on what you've just told us, why is it that homelessness is important, right? Because you seem to have said in the equitable tolling analysis, it's not the homelessness that matters, it's the not knowing. And I'm trying to, so then it must mean that VA knew he was homeless matters for the other issue about whether or not the mailing was appropriate?
Not necessarily, Your Honor. The reason the homelessness is important is because of the VHA's obligations under their homeless veteran outreach program. And we think that even assuming we need to reach to discuss that at all, I think given the board's directive to remail the decision is more than enough to find under Jones that there was some other reasonable alternative additional step to take. But we also think that it was reasonable given the outreach directed by Congress through the VHA that the VA knew he was homeless. Let me back up. Because he was homeless, the VHA would have been aware of that, would have provided outreach, would have coordinated with him for housing and benefits purposes. So the homelessness fact is important to establish the availability of other additional reasonable steps to take in order to effectuate notice. And I think that you know, it's, I won't go there. I don't want to get myself in trouble.
Real-time self-editing.
So my brain works a lot quicker than my mouth does. So, and again, we just, the secretary in his most recent supplemental argument in the response concedes again that the RO, the secretary, and the board clearly didn't do anything, but the RO did nothing after the decision was returned by the post office. He says that on page 7 of his response. And doing nothing is not a reasonable, it's not additional, it's not reasonable to do nothing. That's what the agency did in Jones. And the court said, you can't do nothing. You have to do something. And it's not, again, it's not unreasonable to wait. One of the questions posed by the order was, how long does the secretary's obligation to do something, assuming they have it, how long does that last? And I think that in our estimation, we pointed to the regulation, I believe it's 3.212, the VA, after 7 years without contact, can presume that the person has died. And at the furthest end, 7 years is after that, no contact. I think that's it. But everything in between, again, under Jones, it's what is reasonable under the unique circumstances of that individual veteran. And so we have to take into consideration his homelessness. We have to take into consideration his inpatient treatment by the secretary. We have to take consideration the homeless outreach programs that Congress required them to do since the 1980s. And we have to take into account the unique circumstances that they later received an address. Yes, it was 2007. But during that time, he had been interacting with the VA. The secretary knew that he had not died. He was actively seeking treatment, actively getting his life back together through the great help of the VA. And Mr. Sellers applauds the VA for what they did for him. I mean, they cleaned him up. They got him healthy. And he's now living independently and doing very well. But in 2007, when they finally had an address and he was regularly interacting with the VBA now, the Veterans Benefit Administration side of the VA, it was not, they could have easily provided notice at that point, as the board told them to, when they got the decision in the mail and couldn't find him.
Judge Bartley, do you have anything?
No.
Well, I got a little
wrap up. I told you you'd get the additional time and you've got it. So.
All right. So yes, I would just like to sum up here. Number one, we think that Davis does not apply that deals with the presumption of regularity. That presumption is inapplicable here because as Chief Judge Allen, you indicated several times, we know it never got to him. So yes, the VA, we concede the VA put it in the mailbox with an address that they knew it would not get to him. So Davis is inapplicable. Jones applies. Jones is controlling. Once the secretary knew either before or after the mailing that the decision would not get to Mr. Sellers, the Constitution required him to do something else. The board indicated that something else was at least to send it once they got an address. They failed to do that. The secretary did nothing after this. And that is not reasonable. And under Jones, we think that the court should find that this appeal is timely, either just as a matter of when notice was provided or it was untimely and the lack of notice caused him to be unable to appeal. And that once he got the notice of the decision, he was quickly filed the appeal with the court.
Thank you, Ms. Backus. Mr. Kirshner, we'll give you your full 5 minutes.
Thank you, Your Honor. Just want to sum up on rebuttal here. This is a case, really, it centers around reasonableness. This discussion of Jones, this discussion in Davis, about Davis, what VA has to do under what circumstances, it all kind of goes back to reasonableness. And I think in this case, Your Honors, VA, instead of messing up like what happened in Jones and not providing sufficient notice and having to figure it out later, VA front-loaded the reasonableness here. VA front-loaded the reasonable action. Going back as far as 1993, VA recognized that we were having trouble finding Mr. Sellers' address. And so we contacted the postmaster and we contacted his representative and, you know, made significant efforts to try to find him. And at some point, the decision had to issue. Now, Jones says that reasonable efforts must be taken. But when you look at the specific efforts the Supreme Court talked about in Jones, they listed a few that they came up with. But they listed one that I think is very telling, where they said, no, the government didn't have to go that far. And that one was to look in the phone book. They said that one of the counsel said that, you know, in order to provide notice, they should have looked in the phone book to try to find another address. And the Supreme Court said, no, we think that's too much of a burden. We think that these other things are okay, but the phone book is too much. Here, VA already went above and beyond the phone book before this decision issued.
What about the fact that, you know, one of the things in Jones that they said, you know, is the traditional way to provide notice to a property owner is you go and you tack it to the door, right? Here, you know, within a year-ish of the mailing of this decision, Mr. Sellers was, as I understand it, an inpatient at a VA facility. Right? I mean, so would it really have been so burdensome for the agency that, you know, in your way, and I described it as laudatory, front-loaded it, gone and done the equivalent of not, you know, nailing it to the door, probably not nailing it to its own door, but at least, you know, putting it in with the Jell-O that he got at lunch? I mean, that doesn't seem like a tremendously burdensome thing.
Your Honor, in a way it doesn't, but this court has already answered the question and said, yes, that is too burdensome. Because if we look at Lamb, the court specifically said that reaching out to the claimant's physicians is not necessary. under due process. And you know, VHA, kind of riffing on the argument from this morning in conversations, they're not in the business of providing this kind of notice. That's not something that is how VA works.
I agree that there are earlier cases in the court's history where the court treated the VA as a they, right? There were little parts. But I think that has been significantly undermined, particularly by, like, the Federal Circuit's cases in Lange, for example, where all VA medical records are now constructively before, right, the board, right? So, you know, it's not... It seems to be treating the agency like an if. This gets back to my earlier point to you that this seems like a bad set of facts because the agency tried to do a lot of things right, and it's just a bad set of facts to be making constitutional law.
Thank you, Your Honor. The other point, I mean, Lamb did kind of set those boundaries when they talked about due process and what's necessary. Basically all of the cases that are out there and talk about what is necessary under due process don't show that what appellant is saying is necessary is. We're kind of left, if the court would agree there, that there's something more that needed to be done, it's a pretty big question of what would be reasonable, because the court has kind of already placed boundaries on what it believes is necessary and reasonable for the secretary to undertake. So to go back to my closing, the court, if the court agrees with the secretary, then of course they can move to the tolling analysis on the presumption of regularity stuff. But I think that for the foregoing reasons, as I see my time is expiring, the secretary urges dismissal, and thank you everyone for your time.
I do have one question.
Absolutely.
Do you have any opinion on time-wise, how long should the VA be required to keep looking for him?
Again, Your Honor, this is...
Because it was a year in this case, but, I mean, it could have been... I mean, do you have any...
Well, Your Honor, this is, it goes to Judge Allen's point about strict Davis. Strict Davis would say no time, mm-hmm. And there isn't guidance on in terms of what timeline would be considered reasonable. I don't know if it'd be 1 year, 2 years, 3 years, 20 years. It's kind of an open question if the court doesn't apply the law as it stands, and go with kind of more the strict Davis approach. So here, we do know that we spent probably about 3 years looking for him before the board decision, and then he was again in care, within a year or two after the decision, but he didn't engage with the benefits process for another 10 years after that. So it's an open question, unfortunately, Your Honor, and I think that's why a stricter approach is better here. It's a more conservative approach, and it applies the law as it is.
Judge Bartley, do you have anything?
No, I don't.
Well, we want to thank the parties for their extensive briefing in the case, as well as your arguments on what is a challenging case. And so we will come down and greet counsel, and the case is submitted.